Why your brain doesn't like the Beatles. It's easier to kill a vampire with a stake through the heart than to dispel the assumption that the brain, a physical object, has the power to create the mind. But at least we've seen the fatal flaws in current theories of brain and mind. Dismantling a bad idea, however, isn't the same as finding a better one. We can unfold a better idea through Paul McCartney's beautiful singing of a Beatles classic, Let It Be. Does your brain appreciate the song? Or does your mind? On the brain side of the argument, neuroscientists can pinpoint some specific brain processes when Let It Be enters the ear canal as sound vibrations. Researchers at McGill University in Toronto hooked up subjects to electrodes that measured their brain activity as they listened to music. As one would predict, music creates its own pattern of response compared with non-musical sounds. Raw input that reaches the auditory center in the cortex gets scattered into specific locations where rhythm, tempo, melody, tone, and other qualities are separately processed in a matter of milliseconds. The prefrontal cortex even compares the music you are hearing now to music you expect to hear from past experience. By comparing the two, your brain can be challenged by something it never expected to hear. And further, this can be a delightful surprise, or a distasteful one. The research also shows that the brain gets hardwired in childhood, according to what system of music it's exposed to. A Chinese baby's brain develops specific connections that respond to Chinese harmony, thus leading to its enjoyment. A baby born in the West, exposed to Western harmonies, is hardwired to enjoy that system rather than the Chinese. Finally, the researchers could take a musical performance and gradually change it via computer software to see if the brain notices any difference. Can you tell the real Paul McCartney from the best synthesized version? It depends. As the music becomes more mechanical and less personal, the brain often doesn't notice any difference until the change is glaringly obvious. This might explain tin ears and, at the other extreme, a professional musician's subtle ability to detect the finer points of musical style. Different wiring leads to different levels of appreciation. The research on music and the brain has become quite sophisticated. Yet we'd argue that this whole scheme for looking at music is wrong-headed and will yield no answers that get near the truth. When brain research is medically useful, as in treating Parkinson's disease, for example, or aiding in the recovery of stroke victims, the following factors pertain. A brain function has gone awry in some organic way. The impaired function can be isolated. The impaired function can be observed. The mechanics of correcting the impaired function are well understood. When a stroke victim is wheeled into the ER, a brain scan localizes the area of the blood, and the bleeding is stopped using drugs or surgery. Thus, all the benefits of treating the brain as a damaged thing are fulfilled. Medical science can look into brain functions with ever-increasing accuracy, allowing surgeons to do their work more finely, and leading to drugs whose action is more localized and specific. However, where music is concerned, almost none of the deciding factors are in place. No brain function has gone awry. The brain functions that produce music are complex and mysteriously connected. The actual transformation of noise signals into meaningful music cannot be observed physically. There is no explanation for why the higher brain evolved to invent and appreciate music. Therefore, no cure exists for people who are totally indifferent to music. It's not a malady. Is this just a matter of neuroscience being behind the curve? Would a heap of money in more research grants yield better answers? Not if the whole model is fundamentally wrong. The brain somehow produces music out of raw physical data, vibrations of air molecules. Everybody agrees on that. A radio also produces music. And yet it would be absurd to say that the two are equal. A radio is a machine working through fixed, predetermined processes. However much it may appear to be similar, the human brain can do anything it wants with musical signals, including tuning them out entirely. Everything depends upon what the mind wants. The brain's mechanisms exist for the mind's use. When a person likes or dislikes a piece of music, the mind makes that decision, not the pleasure-pain centers in the brain. When a composer gets inspired, his mind provides the inspiration, not his neurons. How can one be so sure? The answer would fill a book, but let's divide it into three compartments. 1. Determinism is wrong. If the brain is hardwired from childhood to hear Chinese music in China, Indian music in India, Japanese music in Japan, and so on, why do all these countries currently have Western-style symphony orchestras, almost entirely filled with native-born musicians, playing Western classical music? You can't call the brain hardwired when connections can be changed at will. Determinism looks good in the schematics of a neurological network, but it breaks down in real life. By analogy, it's as if brain researchers are trying to tell us that house wiring can change from AC to DC current on its own. That's the equivalent of a brain's deciding to like Chinese music. Only the mind can create such a shift. If a dozen interrelated areas of the brain combine to process music, as opposed to processing the sound of a buzzsaw or wind in the trees, how does the raw input know where to go beforehand? The auditory center receives all raw data in the same way, along the same channels from the inner ear. Yet the data from a piano goes straight into musical processing. This implies that the auditory center already knows which sounds are a buzzsaw and which sounds are music. But it doesn't. We see where each signal goes. We don't know why. Let's roll back the clock to a time when you heard "Let It Be" for the first time. The prefrontal lobes compare new music with a person's expectations from the past. This enables new music to surprise and delight us by defying our expectations. But there are times when new music creates just the opposite reaction in the same listener. You may not be in the mood for jazz one day and yet love it the next. You may be bored by Ella Fitzgerald, only to discover later that you think she's wonderful. In other words, musical response is subject to unpredictable changes. No mechanical system can explain this variability, and reducing it to random neural signals only pushes the problem deeper. The preset chemistry in a neuron can't be expected to produce one response and its exact opposite.